Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody, welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I have the privilege of talking to Meg Gardiner, who alongside film director and writer Michael Mann has written a sequel slash prequel to the hit classic heist movie Heat. Heat 2, which is out now everywhere, is a stunning sort of extrapolation of the characters and the situations to tell us a much broader, much bigger story than the original Heat. It's a fascinating read, really exciting, works as, on its own as a novel, but also obviously the main sort of attraction of it is the way it's going to extrapolate and enrich our enjoyment of the original film, and hopefully, you know, there'll be another film to follow up. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, subscribe, and do all those things that everybody encourages everybody else to do. I don't know if you need my encouragement anymore, really, but there you go. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. But before you do any of that, just enjoy the conversation.
Was a thriller reader from the time I was a kid. Always wanted to be a writer. I took quite a few detours along the way to put food on the table. I went to law school, practiced law in Los Angeles. I taught at the University of California. Had three kids. And when our family, my husband's job was transferred to London from California. And when we were living there and all the kids were, as you say, out of nappies. And I finally had a chance to put my money where my mouth was and started writing. And I've never looked back. So
how long were you in London for?
Long enough that we're now UK citizens.
All right. So you're still in London.
No, I'm in Austin, Texas, but I'm a UK-US dual citizen. So we were there for 19 years.
Oh, wow.
We lived in Surrey. basically. So yeah, and you're in Italy now, though.
Yeah, I'm in Italy for 20 years now. So yeah, and then similarly, dual citizenship. I'm very
better
clean.
Weather.
Oh, so much better, and so much better the food as well. The food. I mean, England is not as bad as people make out in terms of food, but
no, not at all. And it has improved radically over the last couple of decades.
So, oh, absolutely. Yeah. I remember growing up in the 70s and spaghetti bolognese was considered like exotic. It was like, woo, exactly. You know, get you with your...
right.
What are you doing in Austin? Are you working or are you living in Austin now?
We live in Austin. We repatriated. My husband's job came here. And so I can work anywhere in the world. So I'm writing full time, and have been doing that here, there, everywhere for basically 20 years now. Yeah.
Wow. Well, and the benefits of being a writer is, you know, have laptop, will travel.
Precisely. And strangely, you find out that trains and, well, it used to be trains had no Wi-Fi, so that you could get a lot of work done on them, and still planes, if you make an effort, you can get quite a bit of work done on a flight. So as long as you tell yourself that you're going to do it, it's fine. It's really a privilege to be able to do this. So no complaints whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So when it's like when it's a sunny day and I can take my iPad outside with my little keyboard on my iPad and just do a bit of work outside.
Right, right.
Makes it all worthwhile. And so you said you got into thriller writing as a you know, as a reader, as a fan. Who were the people who you sort of aspired to when you first started?
Well, I didn't know I was writing thrillers when I first started. I thought I was writing suspense or maybe mystery. I was a huge fan of Sue Grafton, James Lee Burke, Elmore Leonard, Carl Hiaasen, Stephen King. I loved the big Ludlum thrillers from the 70s and 80s and 90s as well. So I wanted to just write huge stories with life and death stakes, where you could put the pedal down, you take readers on a roller coaster ride and get their hearts pounding, because that's what I loved as a reader. And so I wanted to. Also, I was total crap at writing romance or science fiction or anything else.
Yeah, the what not to do as well as the what to do is kind of an important element of choosing. Yeah, I'm not very interested in this, so I won't go for it. Those sound like some great inspirations as well. A lot of those are on my reading list, definitely, of some of my favorite writers. So how did you then get this opportunity or this chance to write a sequel to Heat? Well, actually, first, what's your relationship to Heat the movie? Did you see it? When did you first see it?
I can't even remember anymore. That it's it just seems like it's always been in there. That you know, I've been a fan. I can tell you, I've been a fan of Michael Mann's work since high school, essentially. Probably that all his television work, his movies, Manhunter, Collateral, Heat, of course, Miami Vice, Crime Story. I was just always blown away and sucked into the worlds that he created, the stories, the drama, the action, the love, the longing, the tragedy, that he was just a master, that I always knew that I would sit transfixed watching anything that he had written and directed. So I, we have the same literary agent. So when Michael started talking about writing a sequel, a prequel and sequel to Heat, he had read Unsub, which is one of my recent novels, and wanted to talk to me, because I have experience writing stories in the form of prose that, you know, 120,000 words. He's an extraordinarily accomplished writer. All his work had been until now for screen and television. So writing screenplays is a different discipline than writing novels. So he had collaborated quite a bit, but had never written a novel. I had written a lot of novels, but had not collaborated. So we we started talking about the possibility that that we could work together to bring his vision of this opus to life, really. And it went really well, thank goodness.
So did he have like some sort of core ideas that he wanted Heat to be, and then or how did you develop the story?
Absolutely. I presume many of your listeners are familiar with Heat, which is in my mind the greatest heist drama ever filmed, and it is an extraordinarily intense action drama set over a period of a very few weeks in Los Angeles in 1995, and about a crew of highline bank robbers led by Neil McCauley, Robert De Niro's character, and the relentless, brilliant homicide detective who is on their trail, Vincent Hanna, played by Al Pacino, and their collision, the way the drama explodes into a running gun battle on the streets of Los Angeles when a bank robbery goes wrong, their deadly showdown at the end, and there's a reason it's become a classic, and it's just, you know, the drama, the action, the ability to love characters on all sides of the law in that movie makes it so memorable. And again, Michael's called it a splinter of time in these characters' lives. This very intense, collision of these two groups, excuse me. And he had always, he knew where the characters had come from in his mind for ages. He had known who they had been, how they became the people they were in the film. For the film, he had written extensive biographies of all the major characters. Hanna, McCauley, Chris Chehurlis, the Val Kilmer's character. And not because he planned to put any of that in the film, but so that he could give it to the actors. So that information would inform their performances. But he had all this material and these stories of who these people were and how they got to be. And he wanted to exploit that. He wanted to bring it to life in a big story. And he also had foreseen, he had ideas of where, let's say, the survivors of the film might go and how they might develop. So he had really been stewing with this for years about wanting to blow out the world of the movie and tell more of the stories. And I was just thrilled by the possibility that he might like to work with me to have that come to life. Daunted, needless to say, when your icon calls you up and wants to talk about having you work with him to bring iconic characters, people who are near and dear to his heart, to life, then you take a little bit of a deep breath. And I realized I've always wanted to write a heist novel, and when would I ever have an opportunity to write one with the creator of the most iconic heist movie that I've always loved, and write more heists, write more chases, write more love stories and loss, and take it back in time to Chicago in the 80s, and forward in time to the new millennium. So I knew it was going to be a huge project, and we talked about making sure that I was the right person to collaborate, that our skills and our ideas for the story could mesh in a way that would really bring his ambitions for the novel to life, because this really is his story. He had the basics of the story already worked out when we first talked on the phone, that he wanted a big section set in Chicago where he was born and raised.
Right.
And with Macaulay's crew, early in their careers, living large, very vivid, taking down very daring scores. And Hannah on the Chicago police force at the same time hunting a gang of home invasion killers, essentially, and how they would, you know, they would come close, but tendrils would overlap, and then the score would lead to more scores. The chase would lead to more chases, and then to go forward in time as well and figure out what happens to Chris, who is the last survivor of Macaulay's crew at the end of Heat. That's not a huge spoiler. After I know that there are new generations of people who are seeing Heat for the first time now, because I was went to a screening recently where it was a packed theater,
right,
full of mega fans, but also at turning points in the film, you could hear gasps in the theater, or cheers, and you realize what a huge percentage of people were coming to it fresh, which was really exciting as well. But you know, at the end of Heat, Chris is nearly dead from a gunshot wound after this battle with the LAPD. He's desperate to escape the city. Hannah is hot on his trail. He knows that if he's going to keep breathing and keep his family safe, he has to leave them. So he is, you know, what's going to happen to him? He's like down to like his last drop of blood. And is he going to make it out alive? And how will he ever keep going forward? So that became a propulsive element of the story as well. You can tell I'm still very excited by this story.
Yeah.
I loved writing it.
I was going to ask you, I mean, first of all, just one thing I wanted to say was, when I first watched Heat, I saw it at the cinema, and I remember walking out and just thinking, yeah, it's good, you know, it's okay, it's fine. Nothing wrong with that. Great gun battle in the middle. And for ages, I sort of had that in my head. That's what it was. And then like 4 or 5 years ago, I rewatched it on Blu-ray. And I just thought, this film is from beginning to end an absolute classic. There's nothing in this that is spare, you know? It's
precisely.
It's that weird thing that it's an epic with no fat, no flab at all. It's just protein and muscle the whole way.
Exactly, which makes it so rewatchable as well. You always pick up something new. The action always pops. You marvel at the actors' performances. You love the music. You love the soundtrack. You love this just like beast of a story that is just like rolling forward like a runaway train. So, how was I ever going to turn that down?
Absolutely. What was the point in the writing process where you sort of felt that you could take ownership of the characters? Because, I mean, as you said, these actors are iconic, and I was thinking when I was reading your book was, one of the big differences between films and literature is that in films, you can go the whole film and not actually even know the names of the characters. Do you know what I mean? Because it's De Niro and it's Pacino and it's, you know, Sizemore and Kilmer. But when you're rewriting a book, it's got to be the names and the descriptions, and they've got to sort of be... sort of come out sharply.
It you know, it's a iterative process. You have to try to gradually get inside the skin of the characters. Fortunately, Michael and I had talked for ages about the characters themselves, how he saw them, who he thought they were, and how they, you know, what drove them, essentially, how the cop and the robber are in some ways, you know, flip sides of the same coin, as Macaulay says in their, when they have coffee, that in Michael's mind, these two characters, Hannah and Macaulay, are the two completely conscious people in the story, that they know who they are, they know what drives their lives, they have no illusions about the world, and they are fully conscious of what they want and where they're going to go and how they're going to try to get it. So knowing, hearing him talk about what drives these people was number one. He had you know, the character backgrounds, which was like just opening a treasure chest to read the biographies he'd written for everybody, and to hear him talk about how he saw the characters developing was extremely helpful. But at some point I have to just take a leap and give it a go. And I mean, that was, you know, we talked, we sent emails back and forth. This was during the start of COVID, so we weren't able to get together initially, and outlines, thoughts. He sent me the script for Heat, the shooting script, which was again extremely helpful because that revealed his authorial voice, Michael's his pure voice on the page, which again was vivid and propulsive, and the, you know, the dialogue was terse, but it just jumped at you, and the action was so richly described that that I knew that that the book was going to be equally rich, but I just had to take a leap and say, okay, how about if I write a few chapters and see how it sounds to you. And fortunately, he liked what I sent him, so we were off to the races, as they say. But it took a long time, constantly during. But this is the beauty of writing, is you can rewrite.
Yes.
And rewrite. You know, send off a section and come back, like, you know, the story's right, but the voice is not there. You're not inside their heads yet. So, you know, he would come up with his understanding of how each of the characters sounds. You know, Hannah is sarcastic and verbose and can overwhelm people with his dialogue. Macaulay is terse. If one word will suffice, that's what he'll use. If that's too much, he'll grunt. that kind of thing. So really getting inside the rhythm of each character's voice really helped, but it took a while. But I couldn't be hesitant, and you know, Michael was there to his dialogue has always been great, so I had no fear that he could turn in you know, sterling prose, but it became a very intertwined way of writing that we would, one of us would write a chapter or a section and swap them back and forth, pages, paragraphs, whatever, so that by the end, I think every word had been hashed over, which is fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, also that it might be a bit of a cliche to start thinking about the subject of your book being analogous to the way of writing a book, you know, like, or is organizing a heist like writing a thriller, and is investigating a murder like writing a thriller? I mean, kind of.
Those are great questions. I had never thought about it that way. I'll have to take a look at that. I mean, yeah, there's planning.
Exactly.
There's recon. You have to do a recce, especially if you're planning a heist, or you're planning a surveillance of people. You have to try to see ahead, figure out what could go wrong. Have you really worked out all the kinks in your story? Have you thoroughly investigated how many exits there are to the freeway within a half mile, so that if one getaway route is blocked, you can still make it out. Yeah, that's not a bad way to do it. So I think from now on, if I'm stuck or bogged down or tired of staring at my keyboard, I'll tell myself that I'm really just laying on a score.
Yeah, it's like the sort of the murder writer who decides, I've thought of the perfect murder that I can commit, you know.
Well, you know, people have tried that.
Right.
There was a woman who was just convicted of she had written a murder mystery, something like How to Kill Your Husband. And guess what? That happened in real life.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I remember. I read that recently. Yes.
She's not on the bestseller list. She's behind bars now. So.
Oh no! So no, not a recipe for success. That's certainly the case. There was some.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Bits in Heat 2 that I really, I loved the whole thing. It was so great to be back with these characters, and it was so great to I think the idea of the prequel sequel thing as well is a really, you can have your cake and eat it, you know.
Good. I'm glad, I'm thrilled that you loved it. Thank you for saying that. And I think the going back and forward in time worked out terrifically, because it really matches the, as I said, the scope of Michael's ambitions for the story. And he was the one from the very start said that he did not want to write it chronologically, like jumping back and then going straight forward to the end. He wanted to interweave different sections, going back to Chicago in 1988, going forward to Paraguay in the late 90s, then back to the U.S.-Mexican border, then forward to Los Angeles and Southeast Asia in the new millennium, which that was as a suspense writer, I found that really crafty. And fun.
You're always keeping the reader sort of on their toes, and I think it's a challenge for a writer, because you've got your reader really engrossed in one strand, and then you've got to have the nerve to, okay, we're breaking off from that. We'll see you in 50 pages. We're going off in this direction.
Well, yeah, again, that can you can use that to your advantage to lead people up to a cliffhanger and then leave them hanging there and launch another storyline, another line of suspense. And you have to immediately lure them into being as attached to the new storyline as to the one that's still the thread that's still hanging, so that they don't get frustrated with you. So, that's again, the beauty of revision. You can make sure you've actually left people hanging at the right moment, and don't leave them waiting too long so that they start to forget or let that storyline cool off. But I'm glad you enjoyed it.
One of the main characters who I think is you kind of learn more about in a way that's surprising in Heat 2, I think would probably be Vincent Hanna. That he's there are certain things he does which you might suspect he was capable of, having watched Heat. But you know, there's no evidence. I read an interview with Al Pacino recently where he explained some of his, let's say, larger acting decisions. In that him and Michael had decided that Vincent would be chipping cocaine throughout the film. Have you heard that?
I've heard it. I've heard it in interviews with him saying that in his mind, that was part of the reason that Hanna can get so animated, that in the film he likes to upset confidential informants or people he's trying to pressure by like bursting out with ridiculous, surprising lines of dialogue. And it's the cop's deliberate strategy to unsettle people, to try to keep them guessing what they need to tell him and keep talking to him. But he had said that in his mind that Hanna became quite animated, because perhaps he was, taking a little bit of coke here and there. And so, yeah, the story goes back to the 80s, and it was the 80s. And this had been in the biographies that Michael had already written for the film that Hannah, and it's mentioned very briefly in Heat that when Nate, the fence and fixer, brings a dossier to Neil about Hannah, you find out that Hannah, you know, he'd come from Chicago. He'd been in the Marines. He had done all this stuff. So Michael already knew that he was a veteran, and you place it back into that time period. We wrote the story that Hannah had escaped his small town childhood and enlisted in the Marines and found himself in Vietnam very soon at the Battle of Hue, where they had to stay awake for 48 hours. And the government was happy to supply the troops with dextrin and keep them awake and in an urgent state of mind. So that is that's not a spoiler or in life or in the story to say that Hannah recalls that. And then as he's in the big city in the 80s, living the high life. Well,
yeah,
he wasn't the only one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it blurs the lines even more. This is I was thinking of one scene again. I don't want to spoil it just in case people haven't read, but there's another scene in Chicago where he blurs the lines in terms of a suspect or a
witness. Yeah. As I said, Michael grew up in Chicago. He mm-hmm. was very close friends with a number of detectives on the Chicago police force and heard a lot of stories about what their lives were like working homicide and the attitude in the department and in the city government and all of that. So Michael was very clear to me we talked about the film and writing the story that Hannah does have a moral pull. Mm. He's not a cop because he wants to protect and serve. Mm. That's not what drives him. It's the hunt. It's the chase. It's as his wife tells him in the film, all you are is what you're going after. Mm. That this is what gives his life purpose and elevates his existence. But he does care for innocent people. He does have a sense that that people have a right to live in peace, and that he is going to be stopping criminals. And the worse the criminals are, the less sympathy he has for them, shall we say? But he's also emotional, and that's all I'm going to say about the scene you're referring to.
good. So I want people to enjoy it as much as I did. So I don't want to. Although I do think the idea of spoilers is sometimes exaggerated. I mean, when I watch a heist movie, I expect stuff's going to go wrong. I'm not sitting there going, "Ooh, I wonder if it'll make it." You know, it's like probably not.
Yeah, they just quietly walk in, hand over the note, stroll out with a little sack, and just drive off to
10 minutes. We're done. The film's over. What's going to happen with this Hamlet bloke? I hope he has a nice time.
Exactly.
One of the things that you sort of had as a kind of a constraint, especially when you get particularly when you get to the second sort of timeline of the novel, is, of course, as you've already said, you know, that Chris is the only surviving member of the team. How was it sort of having Chris? Was there ever a point where you thought, oh, I wish I had Mike instead, or I wish I had someone else instead? How was Chris as a character? How was growing him? Because he also changes as well, doesn't he? He's also the Chris that we get in the 90s is not necessarily the same Chris that we saw in Heat.
Exactly. Chris in the film, he is Macaulay's trusted lieutenant in the crew, his number two. And we get the sense that they are very close, but we don't get a lot of their background. He's a bit of a cipher sometimes in the film. Michael described him as Jumping Jack Flash, that he's kind of a postmodern character that he that he's not fully mature in the film, that he's a young man. He's very volatile and he's a screw up. When he's on the job, when he's doing crime, he is focused and sober and professional and lethal if he has to be. It's not when he goes home to his normal life that he screws everything up. He takes his cut of the score and he bets it on the Super Bowl. He has to pay off the bookies. He loves to gamble. He passionately loves his wife, who's played by Ashley Judd, but he messes up with her. You know, she would like them to be adopting an adult life, and instead he's blown it all in Vegas. So we get the sense that he can't control himself fully in the film. But if you're going to go forward with him in the story, you don't want him just to be the same. He can't be just the same person, because that's not interesting. And number one, how did I feel writing Chris? I loved it, because we didn't know that much about him in the film. But which meant that there was so much to explore and discover and create about him. And if he's going to go, he ends up being shipped out of the country and winding up in South America in Paraguay, and thinks he's in a security job and finds out that he's actually working for a crime family in this anything goes Wild East city on the border with Brazil and Argentina, and realizes, what's he going to do? He's either going to waste away or he's going to turn himself into a new man. And that's the only way he'll ever get his family back. That's the only way he'll ever survive. And he starts to see that the world is changing, and he'd better change with it, because otherwise he'll end up floating down the river face down. But I would find a place where the highest per capita murder rate on a continent to be a bit of a intimidating place to live. But that's only among the crime, the organized crime people are the only ones that are getting killed for business reasons. So he finds it completely freeing and a place where he can become something entirely new if he is willing to reshape himself, which was a fun way to do it. And of course I had Val Kilmer in my mind the whole time as I'm writing every page. So that's always a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's a side benefit. Definitely.
Yeah.
I love the choice of Paraguay as a setting as well. This sort of this place that I don't know much about, and this politics of crime that are going on, which really felt like going into a new territory. How much research were you doing there? Did you go and visit and stuff?
I did not, but Michael had been there. It's right. Ciudad del Este, which is on the border with Paraguay and Argentina. It's a shopper's paradise for tourists. There's some beautiful national parks in the area. It's a real vacation spot. It's a free trade zone, so everybody pours over the border into this city and can get anything they want, which means that all kinds of groups are there to sell anything they want as well, whether it's money laundering, counterfeiting, supplying electronics to narcos and rogue regimes, whatever happens. And Michael had been there when he filmed Miami Vice, the film that's where the South American section of Miami Vice is set. And he found the city absolutely fascinating and really a fertile spot to set the sections of the novel. I mean, I'm trying to picture Mos Eisley or Casablanca in the film, or the Wild West, where everybody knows that the people who own the malls may also be connected to Hezbollah or Chinese triads, or but they are, you know, they're the city fathers and mothers. They are, you know, stalwarts who you know give speeches at the Chamber of Commerce lunches and take photos with the bishop and the mayor. And they are everything is out in the open and above board, and they're business people in that setting. So as long as you're not afraid of violence and as long as you put your life on the line, it's wide open for someone like Chris, who decides he's going to move into the 21st century.
Yeah, and that's it's fascinating, that transition as well that you have of sort of the more high tech end of it comes into play as well.
It was, that's very realistic. Mm. That what was you know, thinking what was happening during this time. That as Chris himself says, that you know, he realizes that he and Neil's crew were the best at what they did. As you see in Heat, they are experts. They are burglars, bank robbers, extreme professionals, technically sophisticated, brave and daring. But he said, was that what we were? It was like we were 19th century banditos, and the world is moving on. The internet exists. You can grab things out of the air. You can make deals from the backseat of your car while you're looking over the waterfalls in Paraguay and being, you know, doing a deal with someone in Indonesia or Algeria. And the world is moving online, and it's moving into international crime.
Yeah. And on that level, you've got sort of that level of high-end heistery and villainy, or feral capitalism, as it feels like as well, you know.
Absolutely. It is. There are several places where Chris is described as a state of nature. Life, if you're not careful, life is nasty, brutish, and short. But yeah. That means it's totally, in his mind, that is a very freeing, exciting place to be. Not all of us feel that way.
No, and then on the other side of the sort of criminal spectrum, you've got this this terrifying character who is he's the opposite of Neil in a way. He lacks control and he's a home invader. How is it writing those sections? Because they're so dark and they're so, you know, is that something you sort of like, you rub your hands and go, okay, now I can work out some issues, or is it something that you're, you know...
A terrible villain in the novel is named Otis Wardell, and yes, he leads the home invasion crew. And again, Michael, having grown up in Chicago, recalled a terrible home invasion crew that was running loose in the city when he was young, right, and later talked to the to detectives about the kind of things that these robbers did. They call them bottom feeders. You know, they're a professional burglar wants to make sure no one's home when they go in to your house. There's no threat to them personally. Then they can slip in and slip out. But home invaders, what are they going to do? They go in. They could be confronted with a guard dog, with someone with a gun. They could be identified. So they have other reasons than just material gain for wanting to go in. They're pretty psychologically messed up. Wardell likes to take control of all the crime scenes when he's in there and work out his mommy and daddy issues on the people who live in these homes. And he becomes an agent of chaos in the entire story. He worms his way into the darkness and then finds out that Neil has been who Neil is, and that he has pulled a huge score, and he starts thinking that why should Neil have all the fun and the money, and so that leads to a number of intersections, let's say, in all the characters' lives.
yeah, fractures and smashes. I mean, one of the things that I found fascinating about his characterization, the characterization of his crew, was that, yes, he's this monster, he's this horrible monster, very uncomfortable to read some of those sections because you convey it so well, as they should be.
Yeah, the violence is not pretty. It shouldn't be gratuitous. It shouldn't go on at length, but it shouldn't be glossed over either. To say why it hurts and why it needs to be stopped.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Well, I was just thinking of there's a brilliant sort of moment in which you realize that one of the characters who's responsible for this horrible crime isn't actually Otis, is actually one of the guys who you've been with, who you've been thinking, well, he's just a sort of hapless sort of he's along for the ride, but he's not as evil. And then you sort of think, actually, this guy's pretty horrible as well, maybe even more so because he's not so monstrous.
You go along for the ride and you get convinced that the ride is okay. And everybody surrounding you is telling you to put the pedal down, so to speak, if I can smash that metaphor to bits.
Oh, feel free. I mean, yes, absolutely. And it just gives a much more sort of broader, more complicated and more textured picture as well. You don't just have this evil and this good. You also have the people who, you know, there are shades of gray in there.
Exactly. There's no one in the entire book who's entirely, well, Otis is pretty dark, but pretty much everybody else has shades of gray, light and dark. But we want to make sure that everybody in the book is a real human being, just like we all are, and that's what readers or viewers, audiences are hoping for. They don't want stick figures. This isn't a video game. We want to feel like we're really walking side by side with these people and that we care for them.
Did you and Michael ever have not a falling out, but a sort of argument about some point in which you had to stand your ground?
We never had an argument. But again, that's we spent several months working out the story, and that was a good time to really hash out plot points, figuring out who might live and who might die and why. So if one of us cared about a turn of events, then we could each make our case to the other. We never argued about anything. We really would, if we saw things differently, we would think about it and talk it out some more. And, think about whether one of us had a more powerful and satisfying sense of where the story should go, or whether we needed to think of something completely new, which we did a number of times. And it was that was really exhilarating, working with someone who has so much experience and who has such a vital and enormous imagination that Michael does. So no arguments, a lot of drafts going back and forth, and then okay, me sending something off to him and getting it back immediately saying try again, which is absolutely fine, because when you have a writing partner who you've come to know and you trust implicitly, then you trust that their judgment is correct, that we could raise our game and make it even more dramatic and satisfying.
What about, I mean, obviously, what another difference between cinema and novels is cinema has these action set pieces, and Heat probably has one of the most, as you say, one of the best film heists or aftermath of heist ever, put to cinema. And this book is packed with some great action sequences as well. I'm sort of, as a writer, I find myself thinking, how the hell do you write action like that where I can see it, that it feels like, it feels like a really skill in itself.
It is. And part of that is experience that I had written 15 thrillers, published thrillers before this. And honestly, learning how to write it on the page, in part comes from watching great films and seeing how it's accomplished and understanding how to translate the visceral effect we get from watching action on the screen to translating that to explaining it in prose on the page. On the screen, you get everything. You get the view, you get the soundtrack, you get the score, you get it's all hitting you simultaneously, and you can't do that on the page. So number one, you have to make sure that readers are already invested in the characters. That's number one, that they right. have to care about the characters, and every bit of action has to explain, exploit, uncover, or develop something about the characters under this incredible stress of this, you know, basically deadly conflicts. And you use prose, you use the staccato sentences or sentence fragments or some way to indicate that you're in the head of the characters who aren't calmly sitting back and you know having a cup of tea as they analyze the action when they're on the street and someone's coming around the corner, the heat is around the corner coming for them. You have to figure out how to put readers into the emotional frame of mind that you want that the characters are in, which is again quite exciting. I love writing action, and when was I ever going to have a more brilliant opportunity to write action than with Michael Mann?
That's absolutely.
God, that's Manhunter, a- Collateral, Heat, Last of the Mohicans, Ali, everything.
Oh my God. Pinch yourself. So make sure you're not dreaming, I think is the experience that you'd have. And of course, you know, you're directing a movie in the novel in a sense, and you don't have to worry about, okay, this is going to cost so much money. You can just like budget, it's no question, you know.
Okay, that's an extremely great point, that when you're filming something, you do have to be conscious of a budget, because if you're actually going to have a used car lot destroyed when an armored car is blown up, that's you know, you have to pay for all that. In the book, you can set as much of the action anywhere. In Heat, it's set in a bank vault in Chicago and on the freeways of Los Angeles and in an abandoned cartel stronghold in Mexicali, on a freighter in the Southeast Asian waters. And you can go as big and bold as you want. You could bring in thousands of people. We could have, you know, this is why you can set stories in outer space if you're writing science fiction. It doesn't cost a single thing other than your time and making sure that your imagination is as bold as possible, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things that Heat 2 really stands up on its own and goes further than, you know, in terms of comparing it with Heat, is that you've got a real globe-trotting feel, that whereas Heat is Los Angeles and is, as you say, concentrated in time, this has exploded out into not only time, but also other parts of the world. I love that aspect of it.
Well, thank you. It meant a lot of research, but it was all worth it. Yeah.
Thank God for the internet.
Well, yes, thank God for the internet and for books, libraries, for Michael's office, which is a research library in itself, and for Michael Mann's incredible dedication to research, which is legendary, and the legend is accurate. he always feels that he wants to understand the world he's writing about, so that it there's a kernel of authenticity there that will resonate with an audience. So, you know, I'm like, what do we, you know, we're going to set this whole, you know, several sections in Paraguay in this city. And he's like, I'll send you some stuff. So they're like, a minute later, 2000 photos arrive and videos that he took when location scouting it for Miami Vice. I'm like, well, we've got, if you're going to have a character climb up the side of a tanker in this, you know, Malacca Strait, I wonder, you know, how would I make that feel realistic? He goes, I'll send you some photos of me doing that.
Oh my God. I hope he hasn't researched any of these bank robberies by actually carrying one out. That would be
But
okay.
He thought we really needed to make sure we would do it the way a professional would. So we did have a long conversation with the bank robber about how you would carry out a tunnel heist.
Oh,
retired.
Wow.
Let me. I hasten to add, retired, served his debt to society, and has gone on to writing and consulting. But very very happy to talk about how he might have actually carried out a tunnel
heist. Wow! Because I was wondering about that. I was wondering when you sort of you work out some of the scores that they have to do. There is a bit of like, right now I'm going to put my bank heist hat on and have a real think about it. So,
well, yes, and you again wanted to understand how someone thinks who is planning to take down a score like that, and what would they watch for? What would they be concerned about? What would excite them? What would scare them? What are the most satisfying and fearsome moments in any anything like that? So it was illuminating.
Wow, brilliant. And so what are the plans now? I mean, is Michael thinking of, I mean, I hear talk that this is going to be made into a film, that there's a possibility that might happen.
Would you be surprised?
I would. I want to see the film.
Yeah, he has said that he has plans to develop it into a film.
So. I mean, it could even be a really good TV show. You know, it could be like one of those six parters or something.
We'll see. You know? We'll see what he's the director. So we'll see what he has in mind.
Oh, that would be so good. And what's next for you, Meg? What's next on your plate?
I have another novel that will be published next year, which is part of a series I write, a thriller series about an FBI profiler, a young woman who hunts serial predators. The Unsub series that will be out in 2023, and then on to more thrillers, and we shall see.
I'm look forward to it. I've definitely got that. I'm going to go back and read some of your earlier ones as well now.
Thanks.
It's been absolutely. One final question I have to ask you, because this is our film podcast, of course. Are there any books that you've read on cinema that you'd like to recommend? Any film writers, either anyone at all?
Well, there are books about heat that have been written, academic explorations of heat that are absolutely fantastic and illuminating. For total fun, there's a book called "The Stewardess Is Flying the Plane" by Ron Hogan, which is about primarily about 70s cinema, but it is just an absolute blast, and the title refers to Airport 75, where the crew is disabled, of course, and so the stewardess is flying the plane. Like all great 70s disaster movies, but that's a lot of fun for film buffs.
Oh, that's such a good idea, because I was listening to someone, I was reading on Twitter, I think, somebody, one of those common complaints of like, oh, 70s cinema was so good and this will never get made anymore. And I was like, I lived in the 70s and there was a lot of tripe as well. I mean, it's just that the tripe we like nostalgically, hence Airport 75, you know?
Right.
All those disaster movies, Poseidon Adventure and stuff. I mean, they were great, but they
the
were
Towering
also...
Inferno. I mean, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, my God. Richard Chamberlain, you absolute shit. He became a symbol of bad behavior for me for a long time.
Right.
What a horrible
weasel.
Man.
Weasel.
Yeah, absolutely. I always remember Steve McQueen and Paul Newman having an exchange, which almost seems to mirror their fights over the prestige in the film, where Paul Newman says, "It's my building," and Steve McQueen says, "It's my fire."
Right. That's right.
You know, who's the most important?
Exactly.
Well, listen, Meg, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for this novel. It's one of those ideas that when you first hear it, you think, oh, don't go there. Don't touch it. It's already so good. And then you read it and you thought, oh, I'm so glad they did. That's such a...
Well, thank you. It's very gratifying to hear that. And I appreciate you having me on the podcast.
Oh, I know this is going to be a popular episode because I know already a lot of my listeners have got their copies.
Great. Great. And it will be out in Italy shortly, by the way. Yes.
Oh, when's it coming out in Italy?
I believe the end of this week.
Oh, wow. Okay, brilliant. Well, this episode should be out either Wednesday or Friday. So my Italian listeners, read it in English if you're my Italian listeners. If you're listening to this, you can manage to read it in English, I'm sure.
Right.
But if not, you can read it in Italian. Thank you so much, Meg. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So that was my conversation with Meg Gardner. Her recommended book is The Stewardess is Flying the Plane, American Films of the 1970s by Ron Hogan. It's a book I haven't heard much about, so I will be dipping into that as soon as I get myself a copy. All that's really left for me to do is to thank Elliot Atkins for the music, Ali Harwood for the art, and thank you, dear listener, for listening. Take care.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.